You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
I'm very throaty, Daniel.
I was trying to be decisive. I was trying to show the listeners, Richard, that Napalm's absence is not going to phase us today.
No, indeed. Lionel is missing today. He's very busy. He's got some top secret assignments this week, which is keeping him away from us. But he has filed, or is in the process of doing his weekly news roundup, just keeping us abreast of everything that's happening in terms of races and so on. Shall we cross over to Watford now to hear from him?
Yes.
Let's go.
Thanks, Richard. Well, it's been a very busy week of racing, so this is really a racing news roundup as the season draws to a close. We'll start with the oldest first, and that's the news that 46-year-old Davide Rebellin has won the Tour de Banyuwangi Lien in Indonesia. It's not a race I'm terribly familiar with, but he has won that. He's been racing at continental level this season for a Kuwaiti team, and he wants to carry on next year. It's now 13 years since he won the Amstel Gold Race, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the space of a little over a week. He's also served a doping ban and was stripped of an Olympic silver medal after testing positive. But Rebellin wants to carry on racing. The German sprinter André Greipel won his first race since the Giro d'Italia when he took the Omloop van der Vesthoek in Belgium. And sticking with Belgium, Britain's Dan McClay won his second race of the season and the first since the end of January at the Tour de l'Euro Métropole. McClay passed the Cofidis rider Anthony Turgis, who thought he had the victory wrapped up but celebrated much too early and was passed by two riders right in sight of the line. McClay, who's been riding for Fortuneo, the French team, has announced that he will be riding with Education First Drapac, presented by Cannondale. That's the new Cannondale Drapac team, and a bit of a tongue twister for us, but they are signing Dan McClay for next season. Jasper de Boistov, Lotto Soudal, won the Binche Chimay Binche one-day race, which is also known as the Frank Vandenbroucke Memorial. Matteo Trentin was second there. And over in Germany, Ireland's Sam Bennett won the Munsterland Giro ahead of three German riders, Phil Bauhaus, Greipel and Marcel Kittel. But most of the focus this week has been on the Italian races, which lead up to Il Lombardia at the weekend. Bahrain Merida's Giovanni Visconti won the Giro dell'Emilia with his teammate Vincenzo Nibali second and Rigoberto Urán third. Luis Leon Sanchez of Astana won the GP Bruno Beghelli near Bologna. And there was a French 1-2 at the Tre Valli Varesini with Alexandre Geniez holding on to beat Thibaut Pinot. You may remember that Geniez was one of the two AG2R riders who were withdrawn from the Vuelta last month after they were filmed holding on to a team car. Nibali was also on the podium at the Tre Valli Varesini, which suggests he's fit and motivated to try and win Il Lombardia as he did 2 years ago. One man who won't be racing on Saturday is last year's Lombardy winner Esteban Chavez of Orica Scott. He crashed badly at the Giro dell'Emilia and fractured his shoulder blade. The women's peloton has also been racing in Italy, with Tatiana Guderzo winning the Giro dell'Emilia and Marta Bastianelli winning the GP Bruno Beghelli. In other news, the 2014 World Time Trial champion Lisa Brennauer has signed for the Wiggle High 5 team after 2 years with Canyon SRAM. Movistar have named 8 of the 10 riders who will form their first women's team lineup for 2018. Stefano Pirazzi has been given a 4-year doping ban after his positive test, which was revealed on the eve of the Giro d'Italia. He was dismissed by the Bardiani team after the B sample was announced as positive for a growth hormone-releasing peptide. But Pirazzi has been banned for 4 years, and at the age of 30, that is probably the end of his career. Something that broke after our podcast last week was that Britain's track sprinter Jason Kenny has announced that he will continue racing and intends to be at the Tokyo Olympics in 2020, aiming for a 7th Olympic gold medal. He also said that he had considered retirement, but no, Jason Kenny rides on.
Thank you for that, Lionel. That was very informative as ever. Mentioned all the races that have been run. A lot of races, aren't there? A lot of races at this time of year. A couple of news stories he didn't mention, which we will cover in the podcast, relating to the discovery at the weekend of a motor in a French amateur's bike. I think in the final part of today's podcast, we're gonna be talking about that. And you are speaking to Christophe Bassons today, aren't you, Daniel? So we'll hear from Christophe Bassons as well, who actually chased down the amateur in question and sounded like a thrilling car chase and found it. So we'll talk about that and the ramifications of it later on. What was the other story that Lionel didn't mention? It was the Rumsas case, which is a very odd one. And I know you've been following that very closely.
Well, it's odd and very disturbing.
Grizzly, really.
Well, it's been rumbling on for a few months now. Raimondas Rumsas, of course, people will remember or may not remember that in the 2002 Tour de France, he surprised everyone and finished. Was he second or third, Rich? He was definitely on the podium.
He was definitely on the podium. I think he was third, but I will just check that, Daniel.
And his wife, Editha, was subsequently stopped by French police. She was carrying found to be or suspected to be doping products, this vast arsenal of doping products. She went to jail. Raimondas didn't come to fetch her. She stayed there for about 40 days, I think. Anyway, 15 years on, this spring, in fact, in May, Linas Rumsas, who was a cyclist and son of Raimondas, died suddenly in slightly mysterious or... again, disturbing circumstances. And then a few months on, so in September, just a few weeks ago, Italian police searched the Rumsas' family home. They searched the headquarters of the team that, or the teams that the sons, so the two sons, Raimondas and Linas, were riding for, and apparently seized a good number of what were again thought to be doping products. And on the same day, we discovered yesterday, they also tested Raimondas Jr., so another son, and he tested positive for a banned hormone. I think is it GHRP6, same substance that Nicola Ruffoni and Stefano Pirazzi tested positive for just before the Giro in May. And in fact, this week we've learned that Pirazzi has been given a 4-year ban for that. So anyway, Raimondas Jr. was the more successful of the two brothers as far as results were concerned. But all very unsavoury. And we will watch with interest what both the Italian sporting authorities and also what the Italian police and Italian magistrates now do with the Rumsas family.
It's a terrible case, whichever way you look at it. Awful to really wrap your head around what's gone on there. And I'm sure more will come out. That's really got the podcast off to a really positive, no pun intended, start.
Sorry about that, Rich.
I did ask. On a lighter note, we will hear from our old pal Ciro Scognamiglio in this episode as well. I caught up with him this morning. He's been obviously very busy at all the Italian races that have been going on. And that builds up to this Saturday's Il Lombardia, as it's now known, the Tour of Lombardy. I kind of alternate between calling it Lombardy and Lombardia. Tour of Lombardy, the race of the falling leaves, and it finishes in Como again this year. We'll talk about that in part two.
No, Rich, no, it doesn't. It finishes in Bergamo.
No, it doesn't. It finished in Bergamo last year. It finishes in Como this year.
Hang on. Yes, you're right.
Yes, brilliant. That's right. definitely keeping this bit in. Anyway, so we'll talk about that in part two. Paris Tours as well, of course, the Sprinters Classic this weekend. Mark Cavendish is riding that for the first... Is it the first time he's... It's not the first time he's ridden it, is it? No.
It's not the first time he's ridden it. But he's never fared particularly well there and never really taken to it, never really made much of an objective of it to the great consternation of people like me who still consider the Paris Tour one of the monuments, really, or certainly one of the... the biggest one-day races in the world. Maybe slightly biased by the fact that when I was growing up, the World Cup was a big deal, a really big deal, and Paris-Tours was, you know, well, one of the final, the penultimate race in the World Cup series. But certainly I grew up, Rich, thinking of it as one of the great one-day races.
But it's most famous for what?
The fact that Eddie Merckx didn't win it?
Exactly, yeah. That is what it's most famous as, I suppose. So maybe maybe Cavendish just trying to emulate Merckx in that respect. But we'll see. His form doesn't suggest that he will, certainly that his results, don't know so much about his form, but his results don't suggest that he'll be in contention. But we shall see. I hope he's not listening. But the races that have... The races that have been on, there's been a lot of them. I mean... The Italian races in particular are really, I don't know if it's just because the season's winding down and we're almost anticipating the end of the season and enjoying what we can while it's still on, but they're a real delight to watch. I mean, Italy at this time of the year looks beautiful. They happen in really, really pretty parts of the country, I've thoroughly enjoyed watching the races that we've had already over the weekend and yesterday. Of course, we're talking on Wednesday, but the Tre Valli Varesine, is that the correct pronunciation?
It's close enough, Rich, yeah.
That was a good race, a great finale, a French 1-2. Alexander Genies, who, of course, was sent home from the Vuelta, wasn't he, for holding on to the team car there. But he won it a really... spectacular finale. Thibaut Pinot and Vincenzo Nibali had been away and looked good for the win. Thought Pinot actually rode exceptionally well, opened up the sprint very early and almost won it. Genies came round him quite late on. So that was good and quite unusual to see a French 1-2.
Yeah, although I was looking yesterday at Pinot's results in Italy. Of course, this season has been unusual for Pinot and unusual for any Française des Jeux rider in the sense that Pinot has actually done the majority of his racing in Italy. And we have talked before about how he seems to relish everything about Italy and certainly racing in Italy. And his results this year have been quite extraordinary. In fact, apart from the GP Bighelli at the weekend, which is a course and a route that doesn't really suit him terribly well, he's pretty much finished in the top 10. Well, if we take only the GCs of the stage races he's done, he's pretty much finished in the top 10 of all of the races he's done in Italy this year. So it's going to be interesting, actually, next year to see what FDJ do with his race program. I think they've already made noises to the effect that he's going to go back to the Tour de France next year and not ride the Giro, but I think he'll probably do that with a bit of a heavy heart, and I certainly see him as one of the favourites for Lombardy at the weekend. Obviously not the fastest sprinter, so he's probably going to have to go away on one of the final two climbs, the Civiglio or the San Fermo della Battaglia, but there's ample opportunity to do that. Those climbs are hard enough for a rider like Pinot to go away, I think, but although Nibali will again be a tough nut to crack, I would suggest.
Indeed. We were going to talk about Lombardy in part two, of course, Daniel, but that's okay. We can be very fluid with the order of things. Going back to Saturday, the Giro dell'Emilia.
Usually we have such a rigid structure.
It's very organized. You know, do consult your script from time to time. Giro dell'Emilia, Giovanni Visconti, and you mentioned Bighelli the following day, Leon Sanchez. Two real kind of old-timers, I suppose, Visconti and Sanchez, who haven't won an awful lot recently, but are obviously very strong riders. Visconti, I wonder if he would have won had Esteban Chavez not crashed, a really horrible crash on the final descent with about 4.5 kilometres to go. I don't know that Chavez was going to bridge that gap, but I think following his crash, that group were far more cautious than they'd been on the descent. It was horrible. I mean, he just hit a damp patch of road, Chavez. His front wheel went. He went down very, very heavily, and I think he's broken his shoulder blade. So a terrible end to a really disappointing or difficult season for him. And he's the defending champion at Il Lombardia, of course. But yeah, Visconti did hang on to win. Nibali came in 12 seconds down, then Rigoberto Urán. But I mean, Nibali and the team, barring Merida, really looked on fire that day.
They've had a very strong end to the season, or they're having a very strong end to the season. And you could argue that they needed to do that because it hasn't been the most prolific debut season for the team. They've, of course, got two podium finishes in Grand Tours, which I think they've suggested that that's unique, that no new team has ever done that before. I'm not sure if that's true. We're usually very rigorous with our fact checking on the cycling podcast, but I'm not going to undertake that task now. But they haven't had too many wins. They won the Coppa Bernocchi with Colbrelli also in September. Visconti won Emilia, but in the first half of the season, they were very, very reliant on Nibali and Colbrelli, and I think that's something that they're going to have to look at next year. Where are the wins going to come from? There have been a couple of disappointments. Navadauskas, of course, has had health problems. Bonifazio has not won any races this year. People like Gregor Bolle as well has not managed to win any races.
Heinrich Hausler
as well. So those the kind of guys who you would have expected to chip in with a couple of wins, 3-4 wins, just to keep things ticking over, have not really come through, and they've been very reliant on Nibali, and it looks as though they're trying very hard to redress that in this latter part of the season, at a time when, you know, certain teams, you can almost see from the way they are racing, are really winding down and looking forward to their holidays, I think, but certainly not the case with Bahrain.
Well, anybody who watched the Emilia on Saturday on Eurosport will have spotted that, as Rob Hatch, the commentator, spotted that Visconti made a beeline after the finish for Ciro Scogna Emilio, stopped at his feet. I suspect that's because Ciro was standing beside the Bahrain Merida soigneur. He knows where to stand, Ciro. And I caught up with Ciro this morning on that race and the other Italian races, with a little look ahead to Lombardia, and also a brief mention of the latest controversy involving Gianni Moscon, the young Italian rider on Team Sky. We'll maybe talk about that in the next part, Daniel. But here is Ciro describing the moment when Visconti stopped at his feet, having won Emilia.
Well, I mean, you know, sometimes I notice, dear Richard and also dear listeners, that all the riders, more or less, after the race, they want to come at me, to speak with me. I don't know really the exact motivation of this. I'm a kind of attraction for riders, I must confess. I have this impression. But anyway, about the race, about the Tour of Emilia, I mean, the 100th edition, the same as Giro d'Italia, was a really impressive race by Bahrain Merida. I mean, this year for the Nibali team has been really successful in terms of the victories, only 10. I mean, it's also true that Nibali was able to reach the podium in the Giro and the Vuelta. But anyway, last Saturday, their race was really impressive, so really well-deserved victory for Visconti, and also a second place for Nibali, that was the inspiration for Visconti. I mean, he gives the green light to Visconti to reach the success in this race.
Yeah, I mean, they're finishing the season on a real high. I guess Vincenzo Nibali fancies trying to win Lombardia.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the parkour is the same of 2 years ago when he won for the first time the Lombardy in Como. I think, I mean, also in Trevali Varesine, he arrived third. He showed a good shape. I mean, certainly the shark is in good form in this period of the year, because we have to remember that his season started very early in Tour of San Juan in Argentina in January. I mean, so he can be considered the star, the main favorite for the Tour of London, Lombardy, but certainly not the only one, because I see a lot of other strong riders, as Thibaut Pinot, as Rigoberto Urán, and we can also keep some dark horses, as you say in English. Richard is correct. You know that your language is not really clear 100% for me, but a dark horse as Davide Di Mella, for example, young Italian. He was the king of the mountain in the last Vuelta, in the last Lombardy. He arrived fifth, and I think it could be a good bet for Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few riders in good form. Visconti, another one, and a very useful ally potentially for Nibali this weekend. Another young Italian, Ciro, who's been riding very well, Gianni Moscon. He's been riding very well, but also creating a bit of controversy. There was some more yesterday where he was accused by Francis Dujeux of causing a crash. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, really a season a little bit controversial for Gianni. I mean, he's really a huge talent. I also had the possibility to talk sometimes about him with Dave Bradford. I mean, and he told me that maybe in the future Gianni could also think to fight for a GC in a Grand Tour. So he achieved really good results this year, for example, 15 Paris-Roubaix. But certainly some things happened. Well, we remember the Russian polemic with Kevin Redza at the Tour of Romandy. He was suspended for 6 weeks by Team Sky. I mean, the episode that we saw at the Worlds before is attacked with the car of the Italian team. Now, I mean, this last polemic, for the moment, it's not really clear. I mean, we spoke with Gianni Moscon yesterday after the race, and he said that he has nothing to do with what happened with the accident of Seb Reichenbach. As a matter of fact, I saw that later he wrote on Twitter, I wish to Sebastian Reichenbach a very quick recovery. I'm sad for him. So, I mean, this last episode, for me, I didn't see the image, so, well, it's difficult to judge for the moment, I mean, for the moment.
It's unclear, yeah. I mean, Ciro, while we've got you, the Giro route has not been announced yet. As you have told us, it usually is announced just after Lombardy, but this year it's towards, you're expecting it towards the end of November, but we know that the start is in Israel. What was the reception like to that in Italy?
Well, I mean, really a mixed feeling in the sense that it's really fascinating only to think that a Grand Tour can start outside Europe. It's the first time for the Giro d'Italia, and in general is the first time for a Grand Tour. I mean, certainly 1 year, Vuelta started from Canary Island, but I mean, Canary Island, we can consider, I mean, politically speaking, as Europe, because it's Spain. So Israel is the historical first time, so this is a good feeling. I must confess that also for a part of the Italian supporters, don't really like any grand start of the Giro d'Italia from abroad, because their idea is that the real tour of Italy is made by 21 stages out of 21 in Italy. So a mixed feeling, dear Richard.
You are covering these races this week and Lombardy at the weekend, then you're on holiday.
I mean, exactly. I mean, I'm obliged. I mean, this race obliged me to work still for this week and maybe also for a part of the next week, immediately the Tour of Lombardy. But I can say to all our listeners that between the half of October and the end of December, I have the beauty of more or less 6 or 7 weeks of holidays. And so for this reason, dear Richard, I'm really motivated, because the really season of holidays, not season of races, is arriving for me.
Brilliant. Well, Ciro, you've earned it, as ever. You've earned it. Hardest working man in cycling journalism. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Richard, and see you soon, and listen soon, dear listeners. Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Hello, my name is James Morton. I'm the head of nutrition for Team Sky. I'm also a reader in exercise metabolism at Liverpool John Moores University, and last but not least, the world-class knowledge director for science and sport. I really love working with boxers. The difficulty for those guys is that they'll have 10, 11, 12 weeks to make weight. So effectively, they're on a calorie-restricted diet every single day for 12 weeks. And you know, it's quite easy to lose 10 kilo over that time period if you build up the calorie deficit chronically. But they don't have to perform in that 12 weeks. They're performing for an event 12 weeks down the line. The difference with cyclists, of course, is although you might have one event to peak for in 6 months, like the Tour de France, you'll be competing in multiple events in the 6 months build up to that period. Footballers are competing every single weekend, sometimes two or three times a week. So therefore, the biggest difference is the amount of energy that these guys consume day by day, depending on what that actual week looks like. But of course, cycling and boxing are mainly about weight loss and fueling for the event, whereas football is more it's more performance-based nutrition on match day itself. But of course, when the summertime comes, everyone wants to lose weight to go and look good on the beach. So I did spend a lot of time talking to footballers about that over the years.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast throughout 2017. We heard there from James Morton, the world-class knowledge director at Science and Sport, who also is the nutritionist for Team Sky. He's got various other roles as well. A reminder, you can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code CPAUG20 at the checkout. That's 20% off all your Science and Sport stuff, as long as it's not already discounted, I believe. So go there, fill your boots. And before we heard from James Morton, we heard from Ciro Scognamiglio, of course, who's looking forward to the end of the season and also his retirement. He's just sort of thinking about when he's preparing to bow out of cycling journalism.
He already has a date, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got a date. I can't remember what it was now. But we're going to try and persuade him to carry on. I don't know if contributing regularly to the cycling podcast counts as journalism, does it?
Maybe we could employ him as our fact checker. No, I think that'd be dangerous. I don't know what he could do for us. Saiolo.
Yeah.
Make us pizza. He could bring us pizza.
We'll think of some role for him for sure. But he talked a little bit there about Gianni Moscon as well. We mentioned that. Third, I suppose, controversy involving him this year. I mean, the question, I guess, is there a link to the first one? Because the incident in question was a crash for Sebastian Reichenbach, the rider on Francis Dujeux, who has suffered a very nasty injury. And the team, unusually, in a tweet, placed the blame firmly at the feet of Gianni Moscon. We don't know exactly what is alleged, but... Moscon denied having been involved in it at all. He says that Reichenbach's hands just slipped from his handlebars. We don't know, but Reichenbach has released a statement now going into a little bit more detail about it, hasn't he?
Yeah, initially it seemed as though the team had maybe jumped the gun slightly by pointing the finger at Moscon, and that you know, we didn't know whether Reichenbach would actually confirm their allegation. He has done that now, apparently encouraged by the team, but we are certain now that, well, certainly FDJ and Reichenbach believe that Moscon caused the crash with aggressive riding. We're not sure exactly what happened, how exactly he caused Reichenbach's crash, but yeah, another unpleasant incident, another stain on the reputation of Moscon, another allegation that he, against which he has to defend himself, and a pattern, well, a pattern of different incidents.
All very different, and I think, you know, your confirmation bias comes in, doesn't it? You're certain when you hear about another incident, you're far less open minded than you would be if it was another rider. And a lot of this stems from the first incident, which was the allegation of, well, not allegation, it was he admitted that he did apologize to the rider, if not to the sort of wider public. But he abused, racially abused Kevin Reyes at the Tour de Romandie, and the way he dealt with that, I think a lot of the other stuff kind of stems from that. The reputational damage, if you like, stems in large part from that, because although he apologized to Kevin Reiser, he went on to the Francis Dujou bus and apologized. He appeared very ambivalent about it in public and in interviews he's done, and in also refusing to talk about it again. So a lot of it stems from that. He didn't deal with that very well. I don't think the team dealt with it as well as they could have done, certainly in encouraging him the right way to deal with it. And a lot of damage was done there.
Yeah, and the doubt that we have is that, or is whether the team would have acted the same way if it, or would act the same way now if it was an inferior rider. The problem that they've got in a way is that Moscon has shown himself to be incredibly talented and certainly one of the brightest prospects that Sky have in their team. And same applies to the Italian Federation and the Italian national team. They sort of, or the Italian national team manager Davide Cassani, tried to take the rap for Moscon when he was disqualified from the World Championships for holding onto the team car. And again, there seems to be a certain degree of wanting to protect a guy who presumably is going to win a lot of races and going to be one of the major names, both in classics and perhaps in Grand Tours in the future. But it gets to the point where his behaviour might become, or might be seen as, indefensible. And, you know, obviously in this case, it's one side alleging one thing and Moscon denying those allegations. So you have to see how this one shakes out. But if it is confirmed that he's ridden dangerously again, then, you know, maybe Sky will have to question, you know, whether he's still going to be part of the team in the future.
It's a real test of moral fibre, isn't it? Because it's very easy to make an example of a rider if he's not the sort of prospect that Moscon is from a results point of view. So and there was a lot of raised eyebrows and skepticism about the nature of the punishment. I think the fact of the punishment was kind of enough in a way. I think the failure of the UCI to punish him as well was a real oversight on their part, and they really dropped the ball with that one. So the test now for Team Sky, for the Italian Federation and for the UCI, if this might go further than that, as you say, there's a complaint being made to the police. But the test for those three sports bodies is what they do with a rider of such promise. If he's found on this occasion to have been guilty of basically physical violence.
And I think what we do know, Rich, and what we've heard from various sources, is that Moscon is someone who is quite aggressive in the peloton. He kind of throws his weight around. He's very competitive. He will fight for a wheel. But, you know, this is his second year now as a professional. He really should have learned already, or he certainly needs to learn pretty quickly what is acceptable and what is not. I mean, there'll certainly be no more excuses and no more slack and no more wriggle room if he gets through this allegation with his, well, reputation not stained any further. Certainly next year, he's going to be under the spotlight even more. And I think it's going to be also policed by his peers. I mean, there's an element of that in this incident that, you know, with those two stains already on his reputation, obviously La Française des Jeux, I think, have decided that, you know, this is strike three almost. Not that he is an easy target, but that they feel there's a pattern of behaviour that can't continue and action needs to be taken by someone. And I think it's going to be the same next year. His peers and other riders are going to be looking out.
Yeah, quite extraordinary, wasn't it, to see a team, publicly blaming a rider for that. That's very, very unusual and exceptional. But so we'll see what happens with that. If there are witnesses to it, then, you know, perhaps the truth will be established. But in the meantime, he's free to race, and he goes into Lombardy on Saturday as an outsider. I would say he seems to be going very well. The race, it's a real racer's course, isn't it? I mean, it's the Climbers Classic, they call it, but It can be won by a bit of an all-rounder as well. And looking at the field, I mean, it's Moscon's got Kwiatkowski, and there are a number of very, very strong teams. Barry Merida have got a couple of cards to play, perhaps. Team Sky, certainly with a couple of cards, and Mikael Landa's riding, not sure what his form is like. Wout Poels as well, a decent shout, perhaps. But Quickstep is a team that really stands out for me. I mean, Julian Alaphilippe, Dan Martin, obviously a previous winner. Bob Jungels, who won, of course, into Bergamo this year at the Giro, just ahead of Thibaut Pinot. I don't know, I'm not sure about Jungels' form at the moment, but he's a Moscon-like rider who is a good racer, a fast finisher, and he can get up the climbs. And Philippe Gilbert, who also is a previous winner. That's an incredibly strong lineup, isn't it, from Quickstep? We mentioned Thibaut Pinot. I think Pinot's got a very good shout as well. Nibali, when he won a couple of years ago, really used his descending skills to good effect to win there. But I don't know, what are your thoughts, Daniel? It does look to be very open.
Yeah, it does. And I think, as I said in the first part, the decisive action will come. I mean, it's perhaps stating the obvious to say this, but it will come on the last two climbs of Civiglio and the San Fermo della Battaglia. We've seen previously when the course has, when these have been the last two climbs on the course, that often the last move has gone on the San Fermo. And the descent is also somewhere where guys can certainly hold an advantage, if not add to it. We've seen that before with the likes of Cunego and Nibali. You mentioned Quickstep there. I'm intrigued to see what kind of form Dan Martin is in. He's done a lot. He's raced less than a lot of those contenders you've mentioned in recent weeks. He's been training at home in Andorra, hasn't raced since the World Championships. Fabio Aru as well is going better than he was at the Vuelta, I think. He suggested that yesterday. He felt very good in the last few kilometres of the Tre Valli Varesine. Nibali has decided not to ride Milano-Torino, so he's putting all of his eggs into the Lombardy basket. So I think he's probably the favourite, Nibali, and Pinot and Aru, and maybe Martin and Alaphilippe are in a bracket just below, probably in the four-star bracket, just below those two.
Hi, I'm Kitty, and I'm the Digital Marketing Manager at Rafa. I started my cycling journey about 4 years ago. When I moved to Rafa, I really loved the sport. I rode a lot. I felt like naturally that I was probably going to get better at riding, but actually the difference has been pretty amazing. And it's not just because you're surrounded by other cyclists who are generally just really inspiring people. What was normal to me was a 30k ride at a weekend. What's normal now is 120k ride at the weekend. And so your expectations of yourself go higher because you realise that this is possible.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor. Grateful to them as ever for their support. And got a bit of housekeeping, a few things to mention at this point. If you're missing our daily Grand Tour coverage and are bereft of podcasts now that we're down to one a week, you can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. You will find lots of podcasts that we produced this year behind the paywall. I think we've produced 9 Friends specials this year, including all our Kilometre Zeros from the Vuelta. A few extras in there as well, such as our Tour de France road trip episodes 1 and 2. And we've got a couple more to come this year. One will focus on the team of the year, Sunweb, which, Daniel, I know you're doing next week. We'll include an interview with Tom Dumoulin. Looking forward to that. And there'll be another still-to-be-announced Friends special this year as well. So it costs £10 for the year. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. A date for your diary, if you're in London on Monday the 20th of November, that's all I can say at the moment. The date, keep it free. We will be announcing very soon what will be happening on that date. But trust me, you definitely want to keep that date free. That's Monday the 20th of November. Something I forgot to mention last week: an email that we received from a listener. Eric Dalton, he got in touch with us through Facebook, asking if we could give a shout out to his good friend and winter training partner, Joni Kanerva, the under 23 rider. He was the Finnish under 23 rider who was hit during the under 23 World Road Race Championship in Bergen by a team car. A really horrible incident. He was really knocked for six and very badly injured in that incident. It was awful to see. There was video footage of it. Dan Martin actually got involved on Twitter on that. It was awful. It was the biggest day of his life, says Eric Dalton, and ended so badly. He is well, but will be out of action for a few months. And maybe next year for him. He is also secretly chuffed with all the press attention, he says. But anyway, we wish all the best to Joni Kanerva, the Finnish rider, and I hope he's recovering well and that he will be back on his bike very soon. So in this final part, Daniel, we're going to hear from Christophe Bassons, the former rider who is now, well, he's now involved with anti-doping in the southwest of France, isn't he? That's his role.
Yeah, I think the official title is councillor or advisor for three regions in France, Aquitaine, Limousin and Poitou-Charentes. But he basically is in charge of anti-doping for the French National Anti-Doping Agency in the southwest of the country.
And anti-doping in this case includes motors and bikes. Tell us just a brief recap of this quite bizarre story.
Well, it was a race in a small place called Saint-Michel-de-Double in the Dordogne, so Dordogne, just in case of pronunciation police are watching, listening, in the southwest part of France that a lot of people, a lot of English listeners all know, very beloved to English holidaymakers. And it was an amateur race, 43-year-old rider, a gentleman called Cyril Fontaine. And he
a gentleman, a cad, surely.
Yes, and he'd ridden, well, he'd been quite successful in local races recently. I think he had competed with this bike five times since August and been doing pretty well. I'm not sure how many of those races he'd won or where he'd finished exactly. But Christophe Bassons and his team had received a tip-off from riders who'd been competing against this gentleman, and they thought he might be using a motor. Christophe Bassons duly showed up at the race on Sunday. He observed and watched the suspected rider and didn't see anything from a distance that looked suspicious, but was fairly confident that there was something untoward going on. The gentleman actually pulled out of the race somewhere, I'm not sure how far from the finish, but before the finish, claiming that he had a puncture. Christophe Bassons then pursued him in his car and asked whether he could have a look at the bike, took out the bidon, so out of the bottle cage, the second bidon, the down tube of the bike, and sure enough, there were wires connecting it to the frame, and the frame contained a motor. So Mr. Fontaine, I think the first motor doper ever to be outed in France, claimed that he had had a hernia, he'd had an injury, and all he wanted to do was compete with his opponent.
Just leveling the playing field.
Well, that's what he said. He said that he thought that other riders in the field might be doping with, using traditional doping substances, and that he couldn't compete with them with his injury, and all he wanted to do was, have a fair race.
I mean, that's fair enough, isn't it? You can't say fair enough. I mean, that's like, that's like one of the lesser riders at Tour de France turning up and saying, well, I don't have the same VO2 as Chris Froome and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, shall we hear from Christophe Bassons now and then talk a little bit more about this?
Friend of the podcast, Christophe Bassons, long-term friend of ours. So, I spoke to him today. You catch the guy red-handed and you see he's completely crestfallen. You say to yourself, this isn't what I got into this for. You know, after we'd got him, I slept 2 hours between Sunday night and Monday morning. I couldn't stop thinking about the look in his eyes. I had to go out walking at 4 a.m, just walking around in the street to process it all. It wasn't easy. It was, tough, but then ultimately he cheated. The guy got taken away by the police, but I was there and saw all of it. You see the guy fall apart. You're there for the interrogation. You see the guy come back to give fingerprints, have his mugshot taken. He's absolutely ruined. It was hard psychologically for me because I'm not a cop. I'm not a policeman. I trained as a sports teacher. Now my work is all about creating information networks, and in this case I got a tip off about a guy who was possibly using an electric bike. It was my duty to at least follow up, because the mission of the French Anti-Doping Agency is above all to preserve integrity in sport. The first bit of information I got was from the local cycling scene, basically to say that his performances weren't normal. The person that gave me the tip off was someone I was pretty confident in, so I thought the suspicions must at least be well founded. After that, I spent 3 days investigating. We're trained to use what we call open sources, in other words, the media, social networks, and everything else we can get access to. I also looked at the guy's performances. But I really spent a long time doing visual analysis of photos, and I saw four specific things about or on his bike that immediately jarred. The first thing was that the bike wasn't the right size for him. He also generally raced on a specialised S-Works bike worth around 7 or 8,000 euros, whereas now suddenly he was racing on a bike with a frame available for 250 euros on the internet. So that wasn't normal. Plus, like I said, it wasn't his size. There was also one wire on the handlebars that had no reason to be there. There was one wire too many for the gear system he had. That didn't add up. Then there were these two casters, red casters, between the frame and rear bottle cage, which looked odd. I couldn't figure out what they were, even zooming in on photos. The fourth thing, and what really convinced me that there was a motor though, was the bottle in the cage on the seat tube. I'd noticed that in the last four races he'd always had the same black bottle, where the battery turned out to be, and that this bidon was always in an identical position. There was a logo or an insignia on the bottle, and this logo was always, always in the same place. That meant he wasn't using the bottle and it was fixed in place there. It never turned. I said to myself, that couldn't be right. So Rich, that was Christophe Basson about how he caught the gentleman in question. We went on to talk a bit more generally about the issue of motor doping. I suggested to Christophe that I probably agreed with what Marc Madiot said in the week, that this is at this stage more likely to be happening in amateur cycling for reasons we'll go on to discuss later. Christophe agreed with me, but he also agreed with what I said to him about the UCI really needing to, well, restore or instill some confidence in the public that they are tackling this problem and do more than they're currently doing. I agree with you, but on the other hand, someone needs to explain to me why the guys, I mean the UCI, aren't taking bikes apart. Why are the tablets all they're using? Why doesn't the UCI get every bike at the end of one race and take them all apart? Look inside all of the seat tubes. You see immediately whether there's something untoward. You could at least do that at the finish of a race. Why do they not do that? Okay, maybe the one we found the other day was a so-called first-generation motor and is easy to detect. But how did I do it? Someone gave me the info and off I went. Took a seat post out, looked inside the bidon and saw there was a battery. It's easy. You can see straight away if there's some kind of electrical assistance or not. Electrical doping is even easier to detect than chemical doping. I mean, come on, don't take us for fools. Even the wheels, there's a big difference between the weight of an electromagnetic wheel and a normal one. As soon as I picked up the bike the other day, I could feel that it was heavy. Of course, the technology has evolved, but there's still extra weight. The weight distribution of the bike isn't the same either. It's back heavy, it's not the same. Personally, I found it hard to believe that people could be using them before I saw the fait accompli. Now this has happened, I can tell you that there are a lot of guys who I've suspected are doping but haven't been able to catch, and when I get back to the office next week, this is the direction I'm going to work in, to check that this wasn't the issue all along.
So that was Christophe Bassons. They were just telling us a little bit about the circumstances around this, I guess, second known case of motor technical fraud, is that what we'll call it, rather than motor doping?
Well, no, there've been a couple more, Rich, in Italy, in amateur racing.
Yeah.
Of a similar nature.
Yeah, I was, Femke van Drescher was the under 23 cyclocross rider. I guess that remains the only case involving a professional rider, if you like, or certainly at the very highest level. So I guess that the obvious question, and it's obviously a line that he's trotted out in his defence, that, you know, he's not the only case. There are lots of other people doing it, and that's the conclusion that people will draw when they hear about a lowly amateur racing with a motor in his bike, that it must be more widespread, that must be the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. I don't really have anything to say to that, because I don't know. None of us know. But Mark Madio was fairly, came out with an amusing line. But you always do get the sense, don't you, that if there's a possibility of getting away with it, there's far more likelihood of it happening. And whether or not the testing that the UCI is doing at the professional level is reliable and to be trusted and fail-safe, the fact that it's testing at all, the stigma of being caught with one of these things in your bike, it's very hard to imagine that it's happening at the World Tour level.
I think Mark Madio suggested that it might have happened in the past, but perhaps wasn't now. There's been a lot of talk about this in particular on social media in the last couple of days, and I think maybe something is lost in translation or in communication. There's one side, or there's one faction of people that say it is rife and it's happening a lot. And then there's another group of people, which includes the riders and people that I speak to and people that we speak to and team managers, who don't think it's a big problem. And when they say they don't think it's a big problem, that's not to say that it's not happening or hasn't happened. But if one guy in the course of a year has attempted it at World Tour level, that might not constitute a big problem by a lot of people's estimations, or if one guy, you know, at continental level has tried it, or a couple, and that is not necessarily what constitutes a big problem, certainly compared to what we saw with EPO and you know, chemical doping, or what we continue to see with chemical doping. I would suggest that that is a bigger plague, and the argument goes that the fish rots from its head, i.e. things start at the top of the sport in the pro ranks, and then they trickle down. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, because it does also depend on the likelihood of getting caught. If you take EPO in the World Tour now, you might be fairly likely to get caught, whereas in the amateur ranks, you're not. Consequently, there is probably more of that going on in the amateur ranks, and I think it's probably the same with motor doping. I mean, I'm sure there are also some amateur races where guys hide behind bushes or take shortcuts, which I don't think happens in the professional world championships or circuit races in the pro ranks. I'm not sure. What do you think? What do you think, Rich?
Well, again, I'm sure it's happened in the past.
Yeah,
I can be almost certain of that. But I just think of the level of the organization, the people that would need to be involved in this at a professional level, the mechanics, the team,
that's another point, isn't it? That, you know, an amateur can show up at a race,
yeah,
and he can race once and then he can disappear and you may never see the guy again. An amateur isn't necessarily training with other guys every day, and he doesn't have to involve anyone else in it. In this case, one of the things that aroused suspicion was other guys saw some of the wires connecting to the motor in previous races in the weekends preceding him getting caught. But if he'd been a bit more careful, you know, they might not have seen, if it had been a slightly more sophisticated system, they might not have seen anything. But, you know, pro riders live with each other and train with each other every day almost over the course of a year. And, you know, that brings a level of scrutiny. You know, we've also talked before about whether it's in the peloton's interest to apply the same law of silence that we think applied or we think has applied with chemical doping in the past. Unless everyone or a large majority of professional riders are using motors, which I don't think anyone really should believe. And there is no interest, or there is no reason for which people would keep quiet about this. And sooner or later, there would be a whistleblower and the whole thing would be blown open. And, you know, based on the feedback we get from pro riders and the pro scene, there is not an awful lot of...
Well,
there's not this big groundswell of suspicion.
I've seen a few comments sort of, you know, almost applying that accusation of omerta on this to professional riders who should be screaming much louder about it and crying foul, etc. But the fact is they wouldn't be doing that if they didn't suspect it was happening. And as you say, if a majority of riders were thinking it was happening, you would imagine that they would be kicking and screaming about it, and that's not happened. I'm not aware of any professional riders kind of even expressing a view that it might be happening at all. As you say, it may well have happened in the past, but it was around 2010, I think, that the UCI first began checking for motors in bikes at the Tour de France, wasn't it, at the Rotterdam prologue or time trial at the start of the 2010 tour. That was the first time they checked bikes, as far as I can remember. And from that moment on, whether the tests have been effective or not, the fact that it's testing at all, the fact that bikes are checked, there's a risk of being caught, and the risk just doesn't, you know.
I mean, that said, Rich, the French documentary that was broadcast recently suggesting that the tablet system being used by the UCI and was not very effective was alarming and frustrating, because this should be quite an easy problem to head down at the pass to eradicate. And I can definitely see foresee a scenario whereby the technology improves, that the cheating technology improves, and whereby this does become a major problem in 20 years. And I can foresee a situation whereby every bike that a rider starts a race on has to be scanned before they take to the start line in 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to sound complacent about it at all. David Lapartion has made it a central part of his mission as UCI president to really get to the bottom of this, whether it's a problem. I mean, let's not forget that this case involving the French amateur, his competitors did suspect him of doing it. There were suspicions based on his performances and so on. And the device sounds pretty crude, really. You know, the bead on, the wires, etc. I mean, it didn't take Basson. He didn't need a tablet or anything else or infrared camera to be able to find this thing. So that sort of device that he was using presumably wouldn't last 5 minutes in a pro race.
No, and I think it's also a mistake to apply the same principles to motor doping as to chemical doping. In other words, to say that, well, this is just taken over from chemical doping on a similar scale. I mean, doping flourished in the way it was doing in cycling, certainly in the 1990s, I think because a culture had grown and developed over 100 years whereby it had become normalised, and the protagonists could convince themselves that it wasn't morally abhorrent. And a system was also in place that facilitated the practicalities of it. In other words, you know, there were a large number of people there who were au fait with how to procure drugs, how to use needles, and so forth and so forth. I mean, even if we believe motor doping has been around for 10 years, no one would argue, I don't think, that infrastructure and that sort of moral structure, moral culture is yet in place. So in terms of the scale of the problem, I think it's hugely disingenuous to suggest that it is as much of a threat, it poses as much of a threat at this point in time as traditional doping. But, you know, as you say, Rich, we don't want to be complacent. And, you know, the testing should be there. It should be reliable, which I don't think everyone has that much confidence in it at the moment. And this should be a fairly easy problem to tackle at this point in time. Perhaps not in 15 years, perhaps not in 20 years, but at the moment, we shouldn't really have to spend too much time dwelling on this. I mean, guys might get caught, but, you know, it should be a fairly rare occurrence, I think.
Yeah, and also with the distinction with chemical doping is that there's a series of pretty small steps that a rider can take. It's a journey from being a clean rider to being a dirty rider. It's not a sudden decision that you make. It's injections, it's legal recovery products, right up to EPO and human growth hormone and all the rest of it. It's rare for a rider to go from clean to cheating overnight. It's a process whereas the decision to put a motor in your bike is a pretty radical decision to make.
And Rich, we often hear that the reason why guys dope is not money or reward, it's ego. Well, by the same token, surely it's a huge blow to any professional who has grown up winning races and being sort of venerated in their circle for being good at cycling, for being a strong cyclist. Surely it's a huge blow to your ego to then, you know, be using a motor to just survive in the pro ranks.
Indeed, yes. Well, listen, let's not dwell on it too long at the moment. I mean, I think it is a subject we'll return to. When we speak to David Lepartion, we'll certainly speak to him about that because, as I say, he clearly thought it was an important issue to make it a central part of his campaign to become UCI president. So perhaps he knows a lot more. He has a lot greater insight into this than we do. I don't know. We'll find out, or try to find out. We should wrap things up there, Daniel. We'll return next week with Lionel, or perhaps offer something a little bit different next week. Let's see. I'm not sure, although we'll have to talk about Tour Lombardy, so it might be a conventional podcast next week. But we have got a few different bits and pieces for you over the winter, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.